is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Welcome to part two of The Making of a Democratic Economy with
Ted Howard, co-founder of the Democracy Collective, and Marjorie Kelly, author of The Divine Right of Capital and Owning Our Future, have teamed up to co-author The Making of a Democratic Economy. Whoa, democratic economy? A clarion call for a movement ready to get serious about transforming our economic system.
The authors illuminate the principles of a democratic economy through its stories on the underground community wealth building and their unlikely accomplices in the halls of institutional power. The book is a must-read for everybody concerned with how we can win the fight for an economy that's equitable, not extractive. Now Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard talk to us about building blocks to economically and politically empower the people.
That I find so enormously attractive, which is you juxtapose, of course, a world where there's 26 billionaires who own as much wealth as half the planet's population with the reality of a guiding principle of the community good and the community first. And the wealth that is generated, which can inherently be plowed back into a collective decision about what the community good is. And that's so encouraging. I want you to talk a little bit about another area where there was cooperative development, which I was a little bit surprised at because it's such a desperately impoverished and oppressed area, and that's the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And there also are the examples of cooperative developments.
Yeah, Pine Ridge, it's a remarkable story. Ted and I have both worked in that area for a number of years. We worked with Nick Tilson, who was one of the co-founders of the regenerative community that's being built there by Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation. And Nick is Native American. He's a young man in his 30s. He tells this remarkable story about reviving Native spiritual practices with other youth and in ceremony getting a message from the elders saying to them, how long will you allow others to control the fate of your children? Are you not warriors? And out of that, these youth decided to form Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation, and they spent hundreds of hours, what is it that we need to develop here? They developed a plan and really a vision for a regenerative community. It's a planned community of housing, homes that can be bought, rental properties, powwow grounds, you know, skateboard park, youth places, spiritual places, places for businesses. And they're training youth in construction skills as they build these businesses. People can also help to build their own homes and earn sweat equity in that way. And they built an employee-owned construction company rather than let all this business go to white businesses from off-reservation, you know, because that's what happens on Pine Ridge is as soon as a dollar is spent there, it leaves within a few hours because there's almost no place to spend any money on Pine Ridge. All these things, and all the homes are going to be positioned for maximum solar. They're going to produce all their own energy. They're going to recycle water. There was a plan to build roads out of old tires. It was designed by a leading green architect. And it's an example of doing development. It's the native way. It's the old wisdom that we've lost sight of, I think, in our country, which is that we are in this together. They don't want children to be going hungry while a few people make themselves wealthy. And this was lauded by President Obama. They did get some federal funding. And Nick is now out taking this model to other reservations and other Native American groups. It's a very powerful model. So it's a truly inspiring model, I think, for all of us.
Ted, one of the most exciting things to come across in a while has been the Green New Deal legislation, which has been proposed by a number of congresspeople. What kind of role do you see for cooperatives in the Green New Deal?
I think there's a very important role. In fact, at the Democracy Collaborative issued a report about this. The Green New Deal, its power is its vision that has just electrified so many people. You know, something you could step into and you could see how to bring together the environment and the economy in a way that's so exciting. There's not a lot of meat on the bones yet of the Green New Deal. It's clearly going to require a very large investment, government funds and private funds. And the question we asked ourselves at the Collaborative was, how do we ensure that as this Green New Deal is implemented and this green infrastructure that we so desperately need and as part of the fight against climate change, how do we ensure that the usual suspects who always get the money in these kinds of big government-funded efforts don't just capture all this money, the Halliburtons of the world, the Bechtels? We've done an exploration and made a lot of suggestions about how to build up at scale cooperative business enterprises, community-owned businesses, employee-owned companies, and have them be the ones that do the work so that we end up not just with green infrastructure, we end up with really quality employment at good wages, with wealth being created in our communities and that are employing the mass amount of people in this country that need employment, and not just a bunch of large Wall Street-based corporations, again, sucking this money out. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity both for the fight against climate change and the scaling up of the democratic economy by marrying these two important concepts in the Democracy Collaborative. We feel that the fight for economic and wealth equality and economic justice is one side of the hand, and the other side of the hand really is the battle against climate change. They're not in opposition. Brought together, they can produce really powerful results in the coming years.
The flip side of that is, you know, why are we not able to deal with climate change? It's because we have corporations and wealth have captured government. Why do we have inequality? Because, you know, wealth is taking the productivity gains that workers are creating. So all of these problems are interlinked with the system that we now have, which is designed to benefit capital. I mean, there's a reason we call it capitalism. It has a capital bias at its core. I mean, we know about sexism, we know about racism. They're not gone, but at least they're not legitimate. Well, capitalism, a bias toward capital, is still considered legitimate and, in fact, in many ways mandatory. So when we say that you can deal with climate change and inequality at the same time, yes, they're linked at the cause, and I think they're linked at the solution, too. We need to build a new kind of economy at the same time that we're building the green energy infrastructure that we need.
And I want to let our listeners know again that we're speaking with Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard of the Democracy Collaborative about their wonderful new book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. And I want to go back to a quote in one of your chapters that, again, was the most insightful for me in so many ways, and that was from James Baldwin. Negro history testifies to nothing less than the perpetual achievement of the impossible. And you dealt with it a little bit before, Ted, but I want you to go even further to the inherent inequality in the nature of our workforce, the enormity of the bias and exclusion and disparate treatment of people of color, and again how a form of cooperative development acts as a corrective to that, as an inclusion of a people that have long been kept on the fringe or as the reserve army of labor or pushed out of the workforce altogether.
That is really, really well said. You know, what I'd say is first, cooperativism as an economic philosophy and strategy began in the 1840s in a small community in the northern part of England called Rochdale. The early Rochdale pioneers, who had previously been Luddites, interestingly, and when the government of Great Britain came down so hard on the Luddites who were trying to resist new technological innovation because it would take their jobs, they moved into cooperative development. And they came up with a series of principles called the Rochdale Principles. These guide cooperativism in the world to this day. Two of them are really important. One is inclusion, that the business welcomes into it any qualified worker who wants to contribute his or her labor to the enterprise, and it's not discriminatory in that way. And the second is a principle of solidarity. We really are all in this together, and the different cooperative companies work to support each other. And this gets to the design principles of the democratic economy, which is, of course, not just cooperatives, but cooperativism as a spirit infuses the democratic economy. One of the important forms of democratic ownership is a community land trust, hedge against gentrification and displacement. It's community ownership of land on which houses sit. In the United States, the idea of the community land trust began in the southern states among black sharecroppers who were being forced off their land. In Jackson, Mississippi today, one of the most vibrant experiments on cooperative business development is taking place, driven by black residents. In the United States, we weren't raised knowing about these forms of enterprise. So cooperativism is something that needs to be taught to people, and we've been educating people in Cleveland, for instance, about that. And people really see themselves in it because it is inclusionary and it emphasizes the dignity of work and really speaks to work is how we help construct ourselves as fully realized human beings. And it's just a crime that we have so many tens of millions of people who've been completely left behind in their ability to participate in the making of themselves through meaningful work.
One of the things that I don't think people realize, and that is the history and the prevalence in many ways of public ownership, of collective processes, which is not so foreign to the United States. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and also give us some insight into the Democracy Collaborative, which we've mentioned a number of times.
I'll let Ted handle the history of the Democracy Collaborative, but I'll just say a couple of things. I've been a journalist for many years. I've been astonished at how so much of this work has been around for decades and still is discovered by journalists as new. Worker cooperatives, here we are talking about it, and people have a great deal of misunderstanding about it. It's been around since the 1800s. There are large worker co-ops, there are large co-ops of many kinds. Credit unions are cooperatives, but it's out of the dialogue. What we talk about is Wall Street. What we talk about is, you know, how the stock market is doing. If you can't invest in it, you know, on Wall Street, then why talk about it? So I think that these things are systematically, they're just not on the map. And that's what we're trying to do with this book, is to say, there's another economy. It's in the making. In fact, it's been in the making by tens of thousands of people for decades. And let's put the pieces together and realize this is a coherent paradigm. And that is what we're doing at the Democracy Collaborative. So I'll let Ted talk about how we've been doing that for close to 20 years now.
So we were actually co-founded by Gar Alpervit, who's just a terrific historian and political economist, and myself back in 2000s. Before saying a few words about the Democracy Collaborative, I want to extend something Marjorie just said, because like Marjorie, I'm invited to lecture during the year. For instance, almost every year, I'm invited to go to the Yale School of Management, their business school, and spend a day talking to a couple hundred students who are being trained as the next business leaders of the United States. When I talk to them about cooperatives, about new principles for the economy, about the fact that it's actually possible to envision moving beyond capitalism into a new system of ownership and land trusts and public banking, this is all totally new information to these kids. They have no idea, for instance, that there are about 8 to 10 million Americans working in employee-owned firms. Well, now there are 10,000 companies in America that are employee-owned, many of them 100% in democratic. So there's been this big shift within the economy that's not recognized. And I think this is really important stuff to get into higher education, because we're training the next generation of leaders in this country. They could lend their talents to building this movement, not to going into Wall Street and financialized forms of enterprise. So at any rate, the Democracy Collaborative, very briefly, we were founded 20 years ago, and our theory of change is that if we want a vibrant, strong, national, democratic culture and life, it needs to be built from the ground up in people's lived experiences in their communities. If we don't embed and grow strong democratic action from the ground up, we are never going to have a successful, meaningful, inclusive democracy. So we asked ourselves, well, if community is the bedrock of where democracy is built, are there preconditions that are needed in communities to allow for thriving democratic culture? One that we saw from the get-go was you needed a stable enough local economic foundation so that your basic needs are being met and you could move into the other areas of democratic engagement, like the school system and planning decisions and all these things in the community. But if you're in a city where your jobs are being ripped away, the factories are closing, your wages are suppressed, it's very difficult to do the other things you need to do to make a local democracy work. And that led us to explore, are there forms of business and structures of capital that are more inherently stabilizing of a local community than others? If you have a company that's owned by investors, it's here in Cleveland, but it's owned by investors 1,000 miles away, they don't really care about Cleveland. And if it makes sense to move the company to Mexico and lose hundreds of jobs to maximize shareholder value, that's fine with them. And so that led us to forms like locally owned cooperatives and employee-owned firms and local community-owned banks and all of these things that are deeply rooted in the community. So we see it as an essential democratic question for the fate of our democracy, that you can't separate the political system from the economic system. And indeed, our book argues, we're saying the time now is to take democratic principles and infuse them into the economy itself.
You know, one of the things, though, that there's this nascent critique in your book, obvious critique around corporate capitalism, but also around state socialism. What's the problem with state socialism? Is it a conceptualization that, as in the Soviet Union, that they became much more, when you look at democratic centralism, they became much more centralist than democratic? I'm just interested in the proposition and concern about state socialism.
First of all, we had this idea that it's a binary choice. There's capitalism and there's socialism, and that just simply isn't true. So the democratic economy is what we're proposing as what's new. But socialism is mostly about what government is doing. It's government ownership, it's social safety nets, it's regulation. And there are socialist countries that work extremely well, and social democratic, I think, in many instances. But what we argue is that social safety nets, regulation, are no longer enough. I mean, regulation is being toppled like picket fences. It's like putting a picket fence in front of a bulldozer. I mean, the machine of capitalism is just so strong. It's out there leveling everything. And social safety nets are being tattered because of tax cuts. And I mean, Trump gave away $1.5 trillion. And so the old ways are failing. And so what we need to do is not just put back what has been destroyed, but move to something wholly new. And that is, we need to finish the work of democracy. I mean, long ago, society democratized government, but we never democratized the economy. We never brought the principles of inclusion and community, and that we're in this together, and we need to design for broad prosperity. We need to bring that inside the economy so that it can never again capture government or destroy government, or it can never again accumulate so much wealth in the hands of so few. That's a different way of conceptualizing.
I am personally a big fan of socialism, but I am not a big fan of the kind of centralized socialism that we saw in the Soviet Union. The Democracy Collaborative in the last 3 or 4 years has done an increasing amount of work in the United Kingdom and working directly with the Labour Party over there, with Jeremy Corbyn's. And they are very forthright. We are socialists. They don't mince words at all. But it's interesting that in their strategy documents, they're looking at how Margaret Thatcher privatized the railroads, the water system, the postal system. All these things were privatized under the Thatcher neoliberal agenda. And Labour has said, when we're in power, we're going to bring these back into public ownership, which is a form of socialism. But they say, but we're not going to do it like we did back in the 50s and 60s, because that was undemocratic. It was bureaucratic, and it was separate from the needs and the wishes of the citizens of the country. We're going to bring back into a kind of socialized public ownership, but it is going to be participatory. It's going to be democratic. So even the Labour Party, which is an avowedly socialist party, and it has that long heritage, even they are saying that form of centralized government control of everything, that just doesn't work either. But public ownership as a concept does, and now we need to marry it to democratic participation, transparency, and responsiveness to the citizenry. And that is in many ways what we're arguing here.
And you have an example of that in Preston, UK, which seems to be working out very well.
Preston is an absolutely fascinating case study. I first went to Preston in December of 2012, and some people in Preston, which is we would call it in the United States a Rust Belt city, an older industrial city of about 150,000 people. They contacted me and said, since you're going to be in the neighborhood, would you come to Preston? Because we've been following the Evergreen work, and we'd like to get some ideas from you. So I went there, and what they did is they realized, again, they were flat on their back. I went to the high street, their main street, in 2012, and it was just boarded up. It was a very depressed community. And because of austerity from the Tory government, there's literally no resources flowing to these cities. Their budgets have been cut. It's a total mess. And they said, well, no one's coming to save us. We're going to save ourselves. And what they did is organize their city council, their University of Central Lancashire, their housing authorities, their police authority, and had them all understand themselves as anchor institutions that they should start buying locally. And they moved 70 million pounds of contracts that used to go to big multinationals based in London, in the city, or in Europe, and moved those contracts back into Preston. Then they found a way to use 100 million pounds of public employee pension money that, again, used to go to the big international hedge funds and so forth, and to equities, and invested in the Preston community and housing and schools and so forth. They're now building a public bank. The university has started an incubator for new worker co-ops, and on and on and on. There's still much more to be done. But the remarkable thing is that in 5 years, Preston has gone from being listed in the government statistics as one of the bottom 20 most deprived communities in all of the United Kingdom to this year being named by the very radical socialist organization PricewaterhouseCoopers, did an assessment and named Preston as the most improved community in the entire United Kingdom, in a city that had no future to it because they implemented the principles and the strategies and structures of community wealth building in service to the vision of a democratic economy. And it's not perfect in Preston. There are still people unemployed, but it is a robust, thriving place in just 5 or 6 years, and they are in the midst of being controlled by the conservative government in this era of austerity. It's an amazing story, and it's the last chapter of the book. We conclude with the story of Preston, and it's very, very exciting. And now that idea has been taken up by the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn's office, we are senior advisors to what they call the Community Wealth Building Unit in Corbyn's office, and there are 35 or 40 cities all over the United Kingdom that are looking at Preston and beginning to build their own models for their own democratic economy. So it's really interesting to me that, you know, where things went radically off the route, off the rails in terms of capitalism, were particularly starting in the late 70s and 80s under Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and the neoliberal consensus that they brought forth that swept the entire world and led us to this incredible wealth inequality we have and everything else. And it all started in the United Kingdom and in our country. And now, it's interesting, 40 years later, it is possible that the vision of the democratic economy, radically counterposed to the neoliberal extractive economy, is being born in the United Kingdom and in the United States. And hopefully this will be one of those history-defining epochs as this economy is built in these two countries, and hopefully it will make a contribution all over the world.
I am now convinced by Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard and the book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. I want to thank you both for being with us. This has been most instructive, most informative, and definitely encourage our listeners to get The Making of a Democratic Economy. It's a prima. It's a model towards an encouragement to building a new economic model that is far more democratic and perhaps the dismantling of corporate capitalism.
And this has been part two of The Making of a Democratic Economy. For part one, go to our website, www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash.